Thank you. Actually, it's the other way around. In fact, this is a bunch of old stuff that I did during my PhD. So I'm not allowed to say anything that I do now, of course, right? So yeah, this is actually closely related to some work that we did. We were looking at these insurance products for these insurance companies. They were selling these very complex guarantees on mutual funds at the time. And I guess we'll go into the story there. So, okay, so the main theme is that sometimes it may not be possible or desirable to go and hedge directly by trading in the underlying asset. So, for example, if you sell a put option or something like that, naturally, if I want to hedge it, I'm going to take some position in the underlying asset to go and mitigate my exposure to price movements. And sometimes for regulatory reasons or possibly because things are very illiquid, I may not be able to do that. And so what the question here is, how does that affect the pricing and hedging of these products if instead of hedging with the underlying asset, I have to go and hedge with some proxy asset? So I'm going to choose something that's very close to my underlying asset. So if I write an option on, I don't know, on some airline, but it's not liquidly traded, and I have to go and trade in some more liquid one, so I'm going to choose some close proxy, how does that go and affect the pricing and hedging of these products? So specifically, as an example, I'm going to steal an old example because I already have pictures and stuff from yesteryear about these Canadian insurance companies. And what they would do is they were selling these very complex guarantee structures on mutual fund investments that they gave, that they sold to clients. And so typically, just to give you a flavor for them, I don't know, are people familiar with like the seg funds and all these ratcheting kind of guarantees that they used to sell? So it's actually closely tied to the person's talk before, where what happened is you go and get let's say my grandpa goes and invests $100 in, you know, mutual fund XYZ. Well, he'd like to get his money back because my grandpa is very risk averse. So what he would do is these insurance companies would say, well, okay, well, we'll attach a guarantee to it. So you get your $100 back at the end of the 10 years or something like that. Well, so that's fine and dandy. So it's very much like a put option. But then if the stock price goes up, let's say it goes up to $150, his guarantee at $100 doesn't seem like much of a guarantee anymore, right? Because it's, you know, even though really you only put in $100, but you feel like a loser if it goes down to 125 or something like that. So what happened was these insurance companies would go and allow you to go and reset the guarantees. So it's one of these multiple exercise types of products. Typically twice per year or something, you could go and lock in a new at-the-money put option that expired in 10 years. So it's a very similar kind of multiple exercise American option that they were selling. So they have these very complicated put options that they sold people on mutual funds. And they weren't able to go and hedge their downside risk. So now we're going to take the view of the insurance company. And they're not going to be able to short the mutual fund. So they go and sell you an option, a guarantee on something. They can't just go around and for regulatory reasons, they weren't able to go and short the underlying mutual fund. So they're going to hedge in some closely related assets. So they'll go and hedge with some indices or baskets of stocks that are close to what the mutual fund is. And how does that go and affect their P&L? So I guess as a first proxy to go and, I know this seems like a reasonable thing to do, let's just ignore the fact that there's a mismatch between the thing that I wrote my guarantee on and the thing that I'm hedging with, and we'll just ignore the fact that there's a mismatch and just hedge as if they were the same. So what I'm going to do in some little simple picture demonstration that this is not a good idea, we'll determine the hedging strategy assuming that it's possible to trade in the underlying asset, and then I'm going to do two things. First, I'll simulate the performance of my P&L if I go and hedge with the true, if I'm able to hedge with the true underlying asset. So assuming it was a perfect world and I could actually short the mutual fund and trade in it, how would my hedging strategy perform? And then secondly, I'm going to look at what happens if I go and hedge with some proxy instrument that's very closely correlated, like 95%. If you could find something that was that tightly correlated, you're doing pretty well here, right? So I'm going to hedge with something that's very tightly correlated, and here, I was doing some discrete resampling, so this one here is rebalanced on a weekly basis. And so I have to ignore the fact that these insurance companies sold these products for less than the no arbitrage value. So my P&L is like less than zero, right? Almost certainly I'm losing money. So they didn't actually lose money, or they haven't been hammered yet, because this is based on people optimally exercising these things and using these reset features intelligently. And that hasn't happened, so they kind of put in there some non-optimal behavior model. So they were actually selling them for less than the no arbitrage value. So don't all rush out of here and try and go and make free money, because you could only buy so many of them, so you couldn't actually make very much arbitrage profits off them despite the fact that they're selling them for less than the no arbitrage value. Instead, what we want to look at here is the fact that if you hedge these things with the true proper hedging instrument, you'd have to have a reserve of about 10 or something like that to go and cover some tail events, right? So down here, in order to, OSFI's going to say, okay, you guys have to set aside, let's say, looking at that picture, probably about $10. So here, what I was doing again, I'm plotting the P&L outcome of a bunch of different situations, scenarios, where I simulated a hedging strategy. So most of the time, it seemed to be around here, but there's a few stragglers, so if I set aside 10 bucks, I'm probably not going to be insolvent. So that's what happens if I hedge using the true instrument, and surprisingly, that's what happens if I hedge with a 95% correlated instrument. Right, so hedging with a proxy. So the reason why we were looking at this question was because OSFI was curious about the impact of what. So if these guys hedge using a proxy model, how much do we have to have them reserve? Right? Are we able to just say have them reserve 10 units, or do we have to go and add some additional reserves due to some basis risk? And surprisingly, like you can see that this is the same product, but there's substantially a lot more variance there. Yep.
Let me understand the hedge.
Okay.
This is the hedge. It would have implemented if you had the real product, but you replace the real product by the
product. Yes.
So you're not adapting the hedge.
So you don't adapt the hedge. So this is what would happen if you went and just pretended that there was no basis risk, and so this is not a minimum variance strategy, in fact, right? If you go on, well, we'll see in a second, this is, in fact, a suboptimal strategy, even from just a risk minimization point of view. Yeah? Yeah, so the value here is the value of your hedge position minus the hedge of any payouts that you have to make. So the value of any hedging strategy, you know, positions that you have, less the payouts that you have to make, and these, because these have this resetting feature and had, you know, so it could happen any time between 10 and 30 years. These products here typically had a maximum maturity. You couldn't reset them after your 70th birthday. So if I remember this scenario correctly, I was doing a 50-year-old smoking female or something like that. So that's why there's a big bulge of things at 20. At 20 years, you don't get any more reset features, so then a lot of people lapse out of the products and stuff like that. But the picture of dots is not really very useful unless you actually know exactly what the product I'm talking about is. But kind of the thing that is important is the fact that all of a sudden, using a proxy instrument, the hedges suddenly perform very poorly, even though they're very tightly, you have something that's pretty closely correlated. Now, the problem here is that you have a bunch of little mistakes that are happening over a long period of time. Notice that the mean level hasn't changed very much. It's still centered about here. So, on average, these things are, you know, it's not introducing any systematic bias, but the variance has increased dramatically. Okay, so we're not going to do this because that didn't work out very well. So, what are we going to talk about in this talk? What we'll do is we'll derive a nonlinear PD that goes and incorporates the effects of basis risk. Anytime you have one of these incomplete market problems or incomplete market, that's actually kind of interesting because then you have some sort of opportunity in there. So there's going to be a bid-ask spread. So that's kind of a nice feature that you go and see in these incomplete market problems. It'll be interesting to note that the special case, in some special cases, our nonlinear model will go and collapse to some famous models such as the Black-Scholes model or to mean variance hedging model that was by Duffy and Richardson. And also, in some cases, the modified equations are, in fact, tractable, and the nonlinearity is not really a nonlinearity because you know what it's going to be doing. So it turns out that you can use some analytic solutions in special cases for calls and puts, but then when you look at portfolios, which you'll have to use some numerical methods, so we'll talk about that too. I'm sure I'm missing out lots of things here. In fact, I know I am because I found more things recently, but there's kind of some related work if you're kind of interested in this. There's a lot of work on mean variance hedging. Schweizer did a ton of it, kind of following up on work by Duffy and Richardson. There's another kind of approach that's similar to this, gives similar answers, but are subtly different. This utility maximization stuff. So there's Davis over at Imperial College, and then some guys at University of Texas. And then there's a bunch. Since it's a nonlinear problem, it will end up that we're kind of interested in viscosity solutions. So there's a bunch of kind of real mathematics papers on first of all, which when you have a nonlinear problem, which solution are you interested in? So it turns out that you're interested in finance, you're interested in the no arbitrage solution, which is related to the viscosity solution. And then there's a bunch of work by Barles and such and Pooley, he's at Waterloo, I did my PhD with him, on finding numerical schemes that you can prove converge to the viscosity solution. It's also, this type of problem appears quite a bit in real options, because in real options you are going and, you know, hedging, quote-unquote hedging, some business opportunity with some instrument that, you know, is hypothetical in the market. So there's actually some kind of interesting insights in Trigurgis's book there, so if you're interested. Okay, so the main result that we have here is that given an asset that's only correlated with the true underlying asset, so what do we do here? This is my interpretation of this mathematics that's going on here. I think of it as I hedge as much as I can using the market-traded instruments, and then there's a part of the risk that's orthogonal to all the market instruments, and that part is the part that's interesting. That's where it depends on the risk preferences that I have or the risk that I have in my book as to what I do with it. So this is where the nonlinear comes in, is the fact that there's some risk that you can't trade in the market. There's something that's kind of orthogonal to the market. And if you're a Martingale person, like Fulmer and Schweizer and Duffy, then they always are looking for some risk-neutral measure, which is, so they're trying to find a measure that's under which the stock price of the Martingale and also has minimal entropy with respect to the historical one. But I don't know. This is the way I think. But if you think this way, then maybe you can translate it on the fly here. Now, some of the older models, such as the one by Duffy and Schweizer and such, they go and hope or more likely pretend that the risk is diversifiable, this orthogonal risk, that's the part that's orthogonal to the market. And whereas some of the newer ones that are based on utility maximization actually give rise to the nonlinearity. So this will be, that will be the focus of the talk. Okay, so I'm going to do some actual, a few slides of mathematics, and hopefully I don't fall asleep while I'm doing this. Yeah, it's actually kind of, this is going to be based on kind of a Wilmot-styled approach. So this is pretty friendly, and this is as simple as I can understand. This is the way I think here. So we have some stock price. We have a derivative V, which is written on S. So I don't know if you guys can understand the notation. I'm sure you can understand it, but whether you can soak it in like 3 seconds while I hammer through slides here. But the key thing to note here is that I have a derivative V, and it's written on the stock S, which follows some Brownian motion thing. But I can't hedge with S. For some reason, I'm going to hedge with H, maybe for regulatory reasons or maybe for liquidity reasons. But for the derivative is written on S, but I'm going to hedge with H, right? So H is for hedge. And it follows some Brownian motion. And these two random increments, so they have different drifts, they have different volatilities, and they have some sort of random increments which are going to be related. I don't know if they're related with correlation rho, let's say. And then what I'm going to do is I'll set up some hedged portfolio. So my portfolio pi, which is a function, my portfolio is going to be worth some function of stock price, the hedging asset, and time. Well, that's equal to, I'm short the option, so I have negative V. Then plus I have X1 shares of the hedging thing plus X2 in some risk-free account. So that's my notation. X1 is how many shares I'm holding of the hedge, and X2 is how much I put in the risk-free account in some money market thing. So I want to look at the dynamics of this portfolio pi. Okay, so in order for the thing to be self-financing, now we pull a few common finance tricks here. So any money that comes in or out goes and just gets slammed into X2, so that gives you some self-financing conditions. So if it starts off with zero initial total value because I've charged the fair value for that product, then I'm just going, in order for it to be self-financing, I just put any proceeds or losses come out of X2 there, the cash account. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, okay, over a little interval from T to T plus DT, the change in this hedged position, so pi is the value of your hedged position, it's going to change by some little d. So d is like a change in pi. Change of your portfolio is equal to negative change in the value of the derivative plus X1 times the change in value of the hedge, plus R times the amount of money that I had in my risk account, my risk-free account times DT. So the last little guy is earning interest. So we have X2 here is earning interest at the rate R. my X1 shares of H are changing by some amount, as however the hedging instrument changes, and the value of the derivative changes according to the differential dV. So what do I do then? And that's the same thing up at the top. Expand using Itô's lemma, that's just a simple application of kind of some Taylor series for stochastic calculus people. You just go and expand the change in value of this portfolio using Itô's lemma, and if I go and simplify and rearrange a bunch of terms, I get something that looks like this. So here I've grouped together at the top line. I have all my things. There's no risky parts in the top line. I don't have any DWs or DZs. Those are the things that I don't know what they are because those are random. And then I have all my risky stuff down at the bottom here. So the change in pi is equal to some deterministic part plus some risky part here. And what we can do now is we can go in. If we were in Black-Scholes land, this would have been a DZ here, and I could have chosen X1 to go and kill my risk term. Here they're not the same, but they're... So I have to make some decision as to what I'm going to do about that risk. So, I don't know, for a simple first approximation, you can choose X1 to minimize, for example, the variance of the hedge position. I'm not suggesting that risk minimization is the best thing to do because, you know, we're not all pathological risk minimizers. There might be some better risk-reward trade-offs. But just for example here, we can choose X1 to go. This is an advantage, or this is kind of the subtle complexity and beauty of incomplete markets, is the fact that now all of a sudden the world is open and you can actually make some choices as to what you do, right? Because there's not, you can't go and make this completely risk-free, so there's not a defined price for it. There's only a defined price under your risk preferences. So let's say, for example, here, I'm going to choose the X1 to minimize the variance of my hedge position. Now, the variance of this thing, if I just do some grade 3 algebra and multiply out things, I just get, I find out that it's equal to this big thing here, and if I go and take derivative, set it equal to 0, except pretty simple stuff, and I find out that the amount that I should hold in my hedge is pretty much what you'd hold in your, like, there's a VS, so there's your usual delta that you get in your Black-Scholes analysis. Plus, it's been adjusted. Let's see if I can. Plus, it's been adjusted by some factor up front here. Notice that that's the usual kind of cap M looking beta regression coefficient, right? So, so your delta has just been adjusted by the correlation and the relative volatilities. Okay, and so if I plug that X1 in there, my variance of my risky or my hedge portfolio is equal to that stuff there. And if you go and do a little bit of, if you look at the variance of dV, that's just the stuff that's in the middle. So essentially what I've done is I've gone and by hedging and holding the position x1, I've reduced the variance of my dpi, and it's 1 minus rho squared of the variance of the unhedged position, right? Variance of dV would be, that would be the variance if I just sold it to someone and didn't do anything. And so by hedging, I've reduced the variance by a little bit. And notice that if rho is equal to 0, then I don't get any, I can't hedge, there's nothing to hedge with, so I get to have the same variance. Whereas if rho is equal to plus or minus 1, then I can hedge perfectly, and so then my variance goes away and I'm back to the Black-Scholes case. So it collapses to some special cases here, which I said there. Okay, so then I go and plug that choice of X1 in here, and I get my change in the portfolio is equal to this stuff here. Now, in Duffy, so that's just simplifying a little bit of algebra here, they notice that the expectation of d pi with this stuff here is 0, which you can think of as being this remaining risk is kind of orthogonal to the market traded risk. dw is the one that's traded in the market, right? That's the one that I could trade. So the expectation of d pi is orthogonal to this thing here, or d pi is orthogonal in some probabilistic sense to that. And so you say, okay, well, then I could like think of taking a bunch of these positions and lots of different types of basis risks, and they all kind of cancel each other out, so I don't have... So we assume that it's diversifiable and we kill that term. That's what Duffy and Richardson do, essentially. And that's fine for some investor out there. Maybe there exists some investor out there that's able to go and diversify this remaining risky part. But that's not the insurance company that kept selling the same type of basis risk over and over and over again. They kept taking on the same position. Is they were always exposed to the basis risk between mutual fund XYZ and index, I don't know, Y or something, right? They were always exposed to the same basis risk. So in their case, assuming that residual risk is diversifiable may not be the appropriate thing to do. Okay, so so how does that go on? So given that this may not be diversifiable to you and you're the person that's selling this product, how are you going to go and incorporate that into your pricing and hedging of these products? Okay, and so now we get to kind of interesting things. Now we get to go and look at some risk-reward trade-offs. So, again, incomplete markets are they're bad in the sense you have to make more decisions, but they're good in the sense that that's probably realistic. So we have to decide upon some sort of risk-reward trade-off, and as a starting point, this is kind of the usual, you know, thing is to go and say the expected return is equal to lambda times some effective volatility. So this is going to be modeled by the expectation of d pi. The effective volatility can be modeled by the standard deviation of d pi, and the market price of risk. You have some scaling factor. So that's the dial that you get to crank up. If your market price of risk is low, then you will take on risk with no expected excess reward. And if you crank that thing up, then you need more reward in order to take on additional risk. So plugging that into, so actually, if we go back a slide here. So here I had expectation of d pi, which was, if you look at the equation two slides back, expectation of d pi is just the top line here because these are normal random variates. So these things, the expectation then goes away. So the expectation of d pi is the top line equals lambda times the variance of this residual risk, which I showed on the previous slide. And gluing all that together, you end up with, and simplifying things, you end up with an equation that looks like this, which is very comfortable in the sense that it looks pretty close to the Black-Scholes equation. In fact, with a little bit of massaging, it becomes even closer. The only difference between this and the Black-Scholes equation, so we have our derivative with respect to time, our theta equals something times our gamma, minus the discounting term, and here our drift term has some funny coefficient in front of it, but other than that, it's a Black-Scholes equation. Now, in a special case, if the delta, Vs is the delta, so if your derivative with respect to stock price has constant sign, then this is not a nonlinear problem. So it's nonlinear because my coefficient there depends on V, right? So it's a nonlinear problem. I can't just go and use it's a little more difficult. I can't use my standard Black-Scholes solver, except for in the special case where that sign is constant. If it's constant, then this is just the Black-Scholes equation with some special drift coefficient. So you can just think of this as being R minus Q, the usual dividend. So you can cook up some dividend that gives you that big weird coefficient there. So you can use the usual Black-Scholes solver in the special case where you're looking at calls and puts. So that's kind of a nice result. Unfortunately, if you add some calls and puts together and you have something that's hills and valleys and stuff like that, then all of a sudden the delta is not constant sign because it's going up and down. And so then you will have to use some numerical methods. So let's look at calibrating the drift coefficients. If you talk with somebody, in finance, you go and say, oh my goodness, writing the pricing model is the first step, and then you have to go and calibrate all these stupid parameters. We have enough problems in industry calibrating sigma, right? We already screwed that one up big enough. If I have to go and estimate mu and the correlation and the volatilities of the different instruments, I'm going to be in big trouble here, right? So, we have enough problems with the simple things. How am I going to go and manage that beast? If you've ever looked at some portfolio optimization problems, the means are notoriously difficult. We just happen to be very lucky that in the Black-Scholes analysis, when the market is complete, the drift doesn't matter. Here I have to worry about the real-world drift, which is, at first, I was a little concerned about. But if you go and look at this, I can write this as, let's say I could put R plus mu minus R. So I haven't changed anything there. And if I just go and add and subtract an R there, then I go, oh my goodness, that's just cap M thing here, right? So all those, so you can go and simplify that. And in the cap M, if you believe in the cap M model, if you believe the market's in equilibrium, those excess drift things happen to be equal, so you end up with just R there. So in the special case where the market's in equilibrium, we don't have to go and calibrate those parameters. And so now we're left with something that's looking a little bit better. If we want to look at the special case of a Black-Scholes equation, if we can hedge with a perfectly correlated instrument, meaning the real underlying, then rho is equal to 1. That whole term, 1 minus 1 squared, disappears. And so you end up with the usual Black-Scholes equation. So that's a comforting fact. If we don't hedge, then rho is equal to 0. And so we're just left with some sort of risk-adjusted expected value, which is also comforting to people from the real options literature or from actuaries. So. Okay, so one interesting thing here is that we're always going to get a bid ask spread. So I've just rearranged this a little bit, and I've gone and put the V tau on the other side here equals a bunch of stuff. So, and I'm writing tau meaning backwards time. Time going, so T maturity date minus real time. So I'm going backwards in time here. And if I go backwards in time, notice that all these things are positive. So like the volatility, S squared, so that's positive, adding value. So let's look at that drift term. Again, if the market price of risk is positive, meaning that you require excess return for taking on a little bit of extra risk, then you know that times the volatility times some positive thing under square root times S times the absolute value, that's adding value, right? That's so every instance of time, you are requiring some sort of premium for going and taking on this extra basis risk. Now, if I'd done this for a long position, I remember my portfolio was for a short position. I had negative pi, and pi equals negative V, and a bunch of stuff. If I did it for a long position, all the signs would have flipped except for the one that's inside the absolute value sign there. So you'd end up with a different sign. So you end up with a bid-ask spread, which is realistic. If I'm selling something, I require extra reward for taking on this hedging position. Or if I'm buying it and I wanted to unroll that position, I would also require the opposite side of reward in order to go and take on that position. So it gives nice to a bid-ask spread, which is kind of a common feature of these nonlinear models. Now, how much of a lambda do you take on? Well, that's up to you, the firm, right? It will depend on the risk preferences that you have. It will depend on what you already have in your portfolio. If you have some sort of basis risk in there already, maybe this gives you some diversification benefits. So what that lambda is for you, so there is some parameter that you have to go and specify, and that will really depend on you and your existing risk profile, which I talk about there. So if you, so there's kind of two things that we have to think about, and if you get one thing out of the talk, and I think it's kind of the observation that incomplete markets are interesting in the sense that they ask you more questions, and those are the two that seem to, if you look at, this is just one special case of an incomplete market problem, but those are the two that seem to pop up over and over again. So the fact that you have to capture some appetite for risk, and what you do will depend on what you already have. So implementation, this is some stylized code here. So the only thing that changes is if you have some nonlinear PDE solver, you just change the drift coefficient. So instead of being drift times S, it's now drift plus some basis risk adjustment times S. Of course, in order to make it one line of code change, of course, I'm cheating here because that means you had to have a nonlinear PDE solver realm that knows how to support that. And in fact, there's some very subtle things that I'm not going to talk about here because they're tedious and boring. You have to be kind of careful that this doesn't jump around. There's an absolute value sign inside that basis risk adjustment thing, right? So you have to be careful that that sign doesn't flip around as you do Newton iterations. Otherwise, you won't be ensured that the numerical solution converges to the viscosity solution, which is the no arbitrage solution. So if you're interested in that, I think Peter is working on, like we wrote it up. I don't think he's finished writing it up, but there's some... how to prove that your discretization actually goes and converges to the appropriate solution is actually subtle, non-trivial. So anyway, just to go on to wrap up here, the kind of the numerical result. So here's some pictures. Again, this is stolen from some old thing, so I'm sorry it's postscript because it was stolen from my thesis or something. But here's some example of looking at basis risk. So in the middle, the line that you can't see that disappeared because postscript dots didn't show up on PowerPoint. Is there in the middle was the no arbitrage value if you were able to hedge without incurring any basis risk. Then what we would do is I then ran it with some lambda equals 12%, vol equals 25%, and rho equals 75%. So this is kind of a reason you could imagine finding some correlated asset that's about 75% close to a mutual fund by trading in some indices or something. You see that you end up with a pretty huge spread here, right? So this is the mid-market. This is on a deal of 100. And so it's like maybe 25. And all of a sudden, it jumps up to like 30. So it's actually, if you wanted to go and price in that extra risk that you're taking on, then it's actually, you know, like $5 on 30 is actually, that's a pretty big difference here, right? It's not one that you want to ignore if that really is your risk tolerance. So. Oh, again, this is some show, I think this is some showed option. So it's something that goes and allows you to go and reset the strike and at the money put option. I think it was 2 times per year for the next 5 years or something. That was this type of product that we were looking at. So kind of the key punchlines here is that you have a nonlinear model. You can drive it using the exact same kind of analysis that you end up looking at, you know, like a Black-Scholes, LL Wilmot and such, you know, just looking at differentials. It's nice and easy to understand. And it has some nice features, but then it incorporates the basis risk. So now if you want to go and add in some different type of risk, you can go and use that as a template and go and say, okay, it's not basis risk that I'm concerned about this time. I have some different type of risk. And the idea is that you can use the same methodology to go and, you know, add in your own aversion to risk by going adding some absolute some penalty, essentially, to your to the value of this product for each unit of risk that you take on. Key points, it collapses to the Black-Scholes and mean variance hedging in some special cases. It's also closely connected to some real options methodologies. And a real important observation is that it depends on your appetite for risk as well as the existing risk profile of the firm. Now, I don't know, Peter might put something on his web, and if you're interested in stuff like that, on some numerical details and lots of I's and J's subscripts and stuff like that, how you'd actually solve these equations. But this is based on work that I did with Peter and Ken when I was at Waterloo. And I should also point out, when I gave this talk in Cornell, and Peter Carr pointed out that, and thought that I should emphasize the fact that, so I was talking about what you would do for a single option. It's very easy to go and extend this to go and handle portfolios of options. So I said that if you're doing a call option or a put option, since the delta is the same sign, it's not a very difficult problem. You just plug into your Black-Scholes equation with some adjusted drift coefficient. Well, but if you're hedging a whole portfolio and you go and add all the payoffs together and you get some, let's say, a butterfly even. So a simple example where you have a butterfly where you buy a call and sell two calls and buy another call, so it makes a kind of a little hat-looking like structure. So the slope of that, the derivative is not constant sign. And so in cases where you're looking at portfolios, you have to go and solve this numerically, but you can use exactly this. It's the same PDE that you go and solve. Now that V is your portfolio of derivative positions on that underlying asset. So it's actually very trivial to go and extend this to handle entire portfolios of options that are traded on a type of basis risk. So I don't know. If you guys have any questions, you're feel free to fire away. Okay, fire away.
So you showed us the striking slide earlier where the cloud for them.
Yep.
When you use the naive hedge with a different cost.
Yep.
So how good is, and now you've derived a variety of other hedges.
Yep.
How good are they? How what would the P&L look like?
So this is a non-optimal hedge, right?
Right.
If you go and look at, it's not optimal because you are ignoring all of this stuff here and just saying that is equal to 1, right? So it's a non-optimal hedge. Now the P&L, like the variance is actually, the cloud does not look that much different in the sense that, it looks a little bit better because you're using an optimal hedge, so it's slightly smaller. But the main thing is that you've actually accounted for that in your accounting. There's nothing you can do about the fact that if I can only hedge with something that's 75% correlated, sometimes they're going to be moving oppositely to the way that I'd like them to move when I'm using them as a hedging instrument. So I should have done a slide here that has this, you're not going to see me circling things on my screen there. Even though I missed this part here, by incorporating this feature, we'll move it. It won't be as bad. But the key point is that. Okay, so. So this is the bad one. This is the good one, and the one using this risk minimizing hedge will be somewhere in between. But the key point is that you've required extra compensation for every unit of risk that you're taking on. So the fact that as it gets wider, as the correlation between the hedging instrument and the underlying instrument go down, it tends to push this thing upwards because you're requiring extra compensation for the fact that you're taking on risk as the cloud blows up. So if the row is equal to 1, it will look exactly like this, in fact, and you will get the same thing. As your hedging instrument becomes further away, this gets wider, but then you require extra rewards, so you push it up, and so you account for that in the valuation of the product. There's nothing you can do about the fact that if the quality of your hedging instruments is not very good, then you are in some sense doomed, right? In the sense of reducing variance. Of course, it will be slightly better than the bad case because that wasn't even optimal. But optimal may not be so hot. But if you have a real risk aversion to that type of risk, then you would crank up that market price of risk, which would push it upwards. Or if you had no market price of risk, if you were fine taking that on and you thought you could diversify it or use it as a hedge, it may be a natural hedge for you, right? Because it is uncorrelated with the market, so it may actually be not bad risk to take on. It might be something that you're very comfortable taking on, and maybe you require a very small premium for that. So it's not clear that... So what this will do is it will just push this thing upwards and recognize that you're taking on risk. No, I was doing the square root of the variance. Now, the reason why you use the square root of the variance rather than the variance, so that's, some people have used the variance in the literature, and the problem, that would be a utility maximization thing. Now, the problem, that's not linear in the number of contracts sold. So there's some advantages to going and using the square root of the variance in your penalty formulation, right? And it's also consistent with people's like Sharpe ratio kind of things, right? I didn't do it very nicely here, but you can write that if expectation of pi minus r, you can go and look at the excess returns over the risk-free rate, and that lambda there ends up being the Sharpe ratio kind of thing. So people kind of like that. They feel good about that already. So. Well, okay, so that's a... Okay, I was going to say, if you have a portfolio of these options, you would only hedge the net of them, right? Because it's only the net that you have basis risk on. Because you only have basis risk on the hedging part. And so valuing a portfolio of these, if you actually valued them all individually and charged this excess premium for each of them on an individual basis, no one would ever buy anything from you, because it'd be like modeling things with a transaction cost model. The bid-ask spread on so maybe think of it as a transaction cost model. The bid-ask spread, if I go and charge the bid-ask spread due to some transaction cost model on every option that I try and sell, no one's going to buy them from me. But I might say, oh, well, this one here offsets a position that I already have in my book. And so it may actually give you some savings, the fact, by selling a position, depending on what you have in your book. By looking at the aggregate, because then it's only the net of them that you have basis risk on. But I never did think about trying to diversify them internally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, mean and standard deviation, actually. Yeah. A mortality utility function? You'll have to define some sort of penalty. Like, so there are other ways that go and look at, there are utility maximization techniques. This is more, I think of this as more as a penalty approach, right? Where you penalize yourself for a particular, so for every unit of risk that you take, how much extra reward do you need? I'm not sure that I see off the top of my head, this here happens to collapse to, I'm not sure that, well, this is similar to a Sharpe ratio kind of analogy. Now, this is over very short periods of time too, right? So it may not, I'm not sure that it's actually all that different depending on which utility function you use, because it is going to be over small periods of time where, you know, price movements are going to be small. But I'm just guessing here right now. But this is a subtly different from a utility-based approach, because this is a penalty-based approach, right?
There are